WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
For the past 20 years, Dr. Andrew Weil has been a pioneer in expanding the boundaries of medicine. His unorthodox approach to medicine started early. While an undergraduate at Harvard in the early 1960s, he wrote a paper for a botany course titled Nutmeg as a Narcotic. The paper was so good, it was published. Weil did go on to receive his MD from the Harvard Medical School and then served as assistant surgeon in the U.S. Public Health Service at the National Institute of Mental Health. But Weil's interest in ethnopharmacology led him away from a traditional career in medicine. He began traveling throughout North America, South America, and Africa, studying indigenous medicine, psychoactive plants, and altered states of consciousness. He's written four books based on his research, which include The Natural Mind, A New Way of Looking at Drugs and the Higher Consciousness, and Chocolate to Morphine, Understanding Mind-Active Drugs. Another of Andrew Weil's books, Health and Healing, has just been revised and updated. It provides a look at medical practices from herbal remedies to biotechnology. Weil teaches at the University of Arizona College of Medicine and has a private practice in Tucson. Andrew Weil, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Faith.
Now, when you wrote Health and Healing 5 years ago, it was described as a pioneering look at non-traditional medicine. Are you happy with how things are being accepted now?
I think so. I see many different trends operating. But in general, there is more interest on the part of patients in other forms of treatment. There is more pressure on regular doctors to be open to some of the new findings about connections of mind and body and to pay attention to the successes of alternative forms of treatment. So, yes, I think I am happy with the way things are going.
I know, though, that you've been working on this personally for about 20 years, and it makes me wonder if you haven't become impatient after all this time.
It would be easy to do that in some ways because there is so much that I see, so many ways I see in which regular medicine could shift and become much more effective, could satisfy the needs of the population so much better. And yes, it's possible to get impatient with that. A few weeks ago, the AMA's newspaper, weekly newspaper, had a front page article decrying the numbers of patients seeking help from quack medicine, and everything other than MD medicine was lumped together under the heading of quack medicine. So that kind of thing makes me impatient.
I noticed that you got your medical degree at Harvard originally, and then you did your internship, and you decided not to go on with training in regular medicine. Why not?
For two reasons, one emotional and one philosophical. The emotional reason was that, in general, I felt that the methods I was being taught were not things I'd want done to me if I were sick, and so I didn't feel comfortable doing them to other people. The other reason was that it seemed to me a lot of the way that I was being taught to treat illness did not go to the root causes of illness and undo them. Instead, they were methods that masked the expressions of illness or blocked illness, suppressed the symptoms of illness. And that didn't feel right to me. And I would argue that a lot of what we do in regular medicine is of that suppressive nature. For instance, the way we treat allergies and autoimmune disease is essentially suppressive. The way we treat mental illness is suppressive. The way we treat many common conditions simply masks illness. It does not undo it. I wanted to find out other ways.
You mean surface treatment, not root treatment?
Surface treatment, not root treatment.
Well, what is your philosophy of treatment?
Let me give you an image. One of the systems that I studied as an alternative form of healing was homeopathy, a system that looked for a time as if it were going to become the dominant system of medicine in this country in the last century, and it was centered here in Philadelphia. The founder of homeopathy, Samuel Hahnemann, a German physician who did his work at the end of the 1700s and early 1800s, formulated a principle that makes a lot of sense to me. He said it was very dangerous to suppress surface illness. The example he used was an inflamed condition of the skin. He said that if you drove that inward, the disease would surface later in worse forms or invade more vital structures of the body. And he wrote that long before we had the corticosteroids, cortisone and its relatives, which are very, very effective ways of suppressing skin inflammations. If you think of the body as a pot full of water and the disease process as a fire underneath the pot, the symptoms of disease are the agitation of the water and the steam coming off. What you want to do in treatment is turn the fire off. A lot of our treatments are like putting a lid on the pot. Immediately they make the symptoms go away. But what are the long-term consequences of doing that?
So you say in your book that your philosophy is use any reasonable method that works as long as it doesn't cause harm.
Right, and I don't really care where those methods come from. I at this point, I don't have allegiance to any particular system of medicine. I have, over the years, worked with and studied osteopaths, chiropractors, naturopaths, herbalists, faith healers, shamans, witch doctors, Chinese doctors. I think all of them have something to teach. All of those systems have elements of truth. There is no system that has a monopoly on truth in treatment. And I take from all of them. And as I said, I really believe in using whatever works as long as it doesn't cause harm, including those treatments of regular medicine, which are right and effective.
Well, some people call those things fringe medicine. Mm-hmm. What do you call it?
I think it's a political choice as to what words you use. I guess commonly I refer to orthodox and unorthodox medicine. The term alternative medicine suggests that you're doing these things in place of regular treatment. And that's not always the case. In England, the term complementary medicine has come into general use, and I like that. It suggests that these other systems complement regular medicine and balance its excesses and deficiencies. And I hope that one trend we'll see in the future is the development of clinics where practitioners of various traditions can work together under the same roof.
My guest is Dr. Andrew Weil. Do you think that England uses the term complementary medicine because people there are more open to these kinds of things?
Yes, and I think some of that is due to the royal family's support of these kinds of medicines, especially homeopathy, to the very prominent tradition of herbalism in England, and I think to much greater interest in mind-body interactions than here in America. So I think there probably are several reasons that account for that.
I read in your book that you took mind-altering substances yourself and also researched them here and in other countries to find out what?
Initially, when I was a student at Harvard Medical School, I was interested in marijuana and its effects, and there had been very little research on it. And then I expanded that to research on a variety of hallucinogenic plants, which I studied in a number of native cultures in South America and elsewhere. I was interested in how people's expectations of the effects of those drugs determined their effects. And I have amply confirmed the suspicion that expectations, or set and setting, as psychologists say, are at least as important as pharmacology in determining people's responses to these mind-active drugs.
You mean they were almost like placebos?
Almost like placebos, but they're not sugar pills because these drugs have effects of their own. And I think that that period of research, when I studied psychoactive drugs, is very relevant to my present work in alternative medicine, because the general conclusion that I came to was that the experiences that people have on these drugs really come from their own nervous systems, that the drugs elicit them or trigger them, but they're from inside. And now what I'm saying in regard to healing in general is that healing is also a potential of the human mind and body. We don't put healing into other people with treatments. We elicit it.
So there you are, wandering through, say, the jungle in Africa or in South America, experimenting with these plants, taking them yourself. What was that like?
Difficult at times, fun at times, frustrating. I never came to harm. I have good guardian angels, and I have a good sense of the limits of what I can experiment with. But I do make, as a general rule for myself, that I don't recommend treatments to other people that I haven't experienced myself, whether that's going to another practitioner or taking a plant. As you know, I use a lot of medicinal plants in my practice today as a result of my background in botany and my studies. I think for every prescription I write these days for a pharmaceutical drug, I probably give out 40 or 50 for botanical remedies.
Did you ever take one of those plants, chew it, ingest it somehow, and say, oh, I hope I haven't made a mistake on this one?
Yes, not often. But I think the human body is quite resilient. And as long as you are sure in advance that something is not going to kill you, I think you have a lot of latitude to experiment. And the worst that's going to happen to you is you're going to get sick for a little while.
I read that you wanted to invent a cocoa leaf chewing gum. Did you ever do that?
Well, this was in the innocent days before cocaine had become the problem it has today in our culture. I worked a lot with Indian tribes that use coca leaf, both as a stimulant and as a medicinal agent. I was particularly interested in its medicinal effects on the gastrointestinal system, for example.
Meaning it would do what?
That it is a great benefit in treating conditions like ulcer and esophagitis and intestinal imbalance. And I was interested in particular about the low abuse potential of the leaf compared to isolated cocaine and what lessons we could draw from that. I found it impossible to pursue those studies just because of the continued abuse of cocaine up here and the prominence surrounding that.
Well, are people now less willing to hear you talk about those things in this anti-drug atmosphere?
I tend, you know, most of what I talk about and write about today is not about psychoactive drugs, but about mind-body and healing and alternative medicine. If people ask me to talk about drugs, I certainly do, though I tend to talk most about the legal drugs in our culture today, alcohol, tobacco, and coffee and chocolate. Because I think most of us are ignorant of the nature of those substances, their potential for addiction and potential to cause us harm.
Did you stop doing it, though, by choice or because you felt it just wasn't going to fly?
I'd say both. I think that that has become such an emotional issue in our culture today that it's just very difficult to talk about. And I think I'll wait for a time when people are more open again.
You think that's a long way off?
I don't know.
One thing that intrigued me in your book, you talked about every person's body being different. So different treatments work for different people. Have I got that right?
Yes. I think that is also why different diets work for different people. You know, we are biochemically unique, each of us. We're anatomically unique, physiologically unique. And that makes it very difficult to recommend treatments or programs that are going to work for everybody. A lot of people these days tell us we have to eat this way or that way. People find a way of eating that works for them and say that everyone else has to eat that way. Same with drugs. Medical students are very poorly prepared by their education for the extreme variability in reactions of patients to drugs. You can read in a book what a drug is supposed to do to people based on animal experiments and human testing, and then you go out in the real world and give these drugs to people, and they react all different ways.
Do you think every medical student should take these drugs?
You know, I don't think it's a bad idea for doctors to have taken treatments themselves. A colleague of mine who was a director of psychiatric residency training at a major psychiatric teaching hospital in the Northeast required that all of his residents take one dose of every medication that they prescribed. And as a result of that, the medicating in that hospital was significantly lower than that in most psychiatric hospitals.
You know, if every person's body reacts differently to drugs, how would they be able to tell whether it was just an individual reaction or a reaction that might affect large numbers of people?
Well, if you give the drug under controlled circumstances to relatively large numbers of people, you can get with some confidence a sense of what the general effects are, and that is the value of doing that kind of testing. But still, whenever you're in an individual situation, you give a drug to a person, you must always be prepared for unique or what we call idiosyncratic reactions, some of which can be toxic.
If everybody is different, how do you make sense of health generalizations or policies like smoking is bad?
Good question. Again, I think all you can do is have some statistical sense of the dangers or benefits of certain courses of action. In the case of cigarettes, I'm sure you have met people in their 70s and 80s who have smoked two packs of cigarettes all their lives and are hale and hearty and can march up hills better than we can. And that means probably that those people have healthy constitutions and strong respiratory systems and that their enzymes for repairing cellular damage from that might cause cancer are in good working order. That doesn't mean that everybody can smoke with license. It doesn't work that way, but some people can do it.
Should you have a policy?
I think, again, that that should be based on statistical considerations. In the case of cigarettes, I think the statistical risks of cigarette smoking are great enough to warrant a policy, especially since, in the case of cigarettes, non-users are exposed to that substance. And there is accumulating evidence that passive inhalation of cigarette smoke can be a significant factor in disease.
My guest is Dr. Andrew Weil. He's been a longtime pioneer in the field of holistic health. A revised edition of his book, Health and Healing, has just been published. We'll talk more after this short break. This is Fresh Air. This is Dr. Andrew Weil, author of Health and Healing. Do you believe in physicals?
I guess no, not on a regular basis. I think that it is good to have a sense of your own body, to go in for specific kinds of tests. But in the absence of trouble, if you are taking good preventive measures, now those are two big ifs, I don't think it is necessary to have an annual physical.
Why do I get the feeling that presidents benefit by them?
Well, I think they have great publicity value.
Well, you know, it seems like every time they take one, they find something.
And that's a danger, by the way. I think there is a danger of going looking for trouble in the absence of any visible signs of trouble. I think it is better to put energy into good preventive maintenance. Now, a lot of people in this culture don't want to do that. I mean, there is an attitude that's quite prevalent of being very passive. You know, the idea is that you can do whatever you want, and there are going to be doctors waiting at the end of the line to rescue you from the results of your folly, whether that's giving you a new heart or something like that. I think it is much better to put energy into preventive maintenance.
Well, do they find things on presidents because they use special equipment on them that they don't use on us?
Well, some presidents are very old.
Yeah. Do you believe in the connection between emotion and state of health?
Sure. And I think that any clinician who is sensitive to the emotional states of his or her patients sees many kinds of conditions that fluctuate with the ups and downs of a person's emotional life. I think that's especially true of autoimmune diseases and allergies, for example, that if you look at a condition like rheumatoid arthritis or lupus, these are major autoimmune diseases. These are diseases that tend to vary, that they have remissions and exacerbations, and these ups and downs often correlate with ups and downs of people's emotional state.
Is there a danger, though, that when it comes to the emotion-health connection, that will cause patients to blame themselves for their illnesses?
Of course there is, and I think we're doing that already. That's especially, I see that happening a lot in alternative approaches to cancer. Where some physicians and other kinds of workers suggest to patients, and sometimes say as much directly, that people gave themselves cancer, or you got cancer because you bottled up your emotions or didn't express anger. That doesn't do any good. I mean, all that does, as far as I can see, is to saddle people with cancer with a great deal more guilt and despair than they've had to begin with, and that's counterproductive. If, in fact, you take seriously the idea that guilt and depression and grief can suppress immunity, which I think they can, then you want to work as a physician to relieve people of that kind of burden, not to add to it.
How do you behave when you're sick?
Well, you ought to ask the people around me. I don't get sick that often, and when I do, I usually know how to take care of myself. I don't usually have need to go to outside practitioners, and I recommend that as the best course of action. I think it is good to find ways to be more self-reliant in terms of illness. So, you know, I do all the things I know how to do, and if it's bad enough, I stay in bed for a few days.
Do you feel sorry for yourself?
Yeah, sure. I feel sorry and I feel angry, and I think those are often normal parts of being sick. One of the principles that I wrote about in my book is that it's all right to be sick. I don't think getting sick means that you failed in some way or that you're to be blamed. I think sickness is part of life, that there are alternations of being in the relative balance of health and having that balance break down periodically. I think that's just part of the way things are. And I think it helps if you don't obsess too much about feeling guilty or angry about that state, but just let it pass and get through it as efficiently as possible.
When you were growing up, how did the people around you, say your parents, treat you when you were sick?
Oh, I think they took good care of me. I remember I have a lot of pleasant memories of being in bed as a kid and reading comic books and, you know, getting things I didn't get to eat all the time. And you know, I remember that experience.
Does that affect the way that you're a doctor now?
It must. I'm not sure I can say exactly how. I have a general practice. I see a wide variety of patients with many sorts of conditions. I see people who are well and simply want preventive medical assessments, which I strongly encourage, and I see people with overwhelming diseases. And I think the main strategy that I try to use is to empower people to deal better with their own problems. That is to give them information and techniques and resources by which they can maximally use their own potential for healing.
Dr. Andrew Weil, the author of Health and Healing, among other books, is my guest. Do you still have your tonsils?
No, I it was very difficult. I'm now 45, and I grew up here in Philadelphia. And in my generation, I think it was almost impossible for a child to make it to adolescence with tonsils. That was because the medical profession taught that tonsils were useless organs, functionless organs, and that gave surgeons the license to take them out at the first sign of trouble. We now know that tonsils and adenoids are vital structures of the immune system, and they're there for a very good purpose, which is to facilitate meetings between immune tissues and germs that might enter the body by that route and help us develop lifelong immunity. It's interesting, by the way, that almost every major organ of the immune system until very recently was considered a functionless organ.
Well, you said in your book that tonsils really were an example of the trendy operations, things being taken out in droves.
And one of the lessons of some of this, there's a worse case with the thymus gland, which I also cited in the book. This is the gland behind the breastbone that's the master gland of the endocrine system. And even when I was in medical school, its function was little understood, just beginning to be understood. But for years, doctors had taught that this was a functionless organ. It shrank in adolescence, and that was taken proof that it was functionless. In the 1950s, doctors at leading academic medical centers invented a disease that every child had called thymic hypertrophy, meaning the thymus is too large, treatable by shooting X-rays at it, which makes it shrivel up immediately. And this was done to large numbers of children of middle-class and upper-class parents in this country. Years later, we find that many people that had this treatment developed thyroid cancer because of the radiation exposure in that region. I think that when you read accounts of this, which the medical profession would like us to forget, it ought to make us wary of new treatments. You know, what are the things we're doing today that we're going to look back on 20 or 30 years from now with the same open-mouth disbelief that we hear of this episode of bombarding thymuses with X-rays?
You've joined the list of people who publicly criticize their own professions. I think that as I hear you criticizing them now. Mm-hmm. How does it feel when your colleagues get mad at you?
I don't find that happens very often anymore. And that, to me, suggests that the medical profession is a bit more open than it was before. The University of Arizona College of Medicine asked me to teach there on this subject. They asked for teaching about alternative systems of medicine and other kinds of medical philosophies. The economic crunch on medicine is so great right now that I think it's forcing some openness in ideology, which wasn't there previously. And the demand for among patients for other kinds of treatments is so great that I think at least some doctors are willing to listen to all this. So I don't find that so much.
What about your difficulty in non-traditional health meetings? Are there people there who expect you to embrace everything they're doing?
Absolutely, and I will not do that. I see, as you know, an awful lot of nonsense that goes on under the banner of alternative medicine and holistic medicine. Many holistic practitioners embrace methods of unproved value and reject everything orthodox as wrong, and that's not the way it should be. If I have any complaint, it's that sometimes I feel rather lonely being in the middle. You know, that I try to stake out a middle line of taking, as I said, the best of all these systems and synthesizing a new kind of medical practice. I guess you'd call it a kind of eclectic medicine that takes the best elements of all of these.
So you do feel like a middleman.
Yes.
When medical journals come out with articles and say one thing, and then they come out with articles the next week and say completely the opposite, we don't know what to do. What are we supposed to do? What do you do?
Well, you know, I think there ought to be a course for people as to how to interpret medical research, because you just can't believe the results of everything that you see. you have to judge it on how well the data were gathered and whether the experiments were done correctly. A lot of cases, that's not true. An awful lot of medical research is not of very good quality.
So in the end, do you think that we should all be shooting for perfect health?
Perfect health is not obtainable. I think any system or person that tells you that you can be healthy forever if you do this or that is not to be believed. Health is a temporary state of balance and alignment with all the forces inside and out of you. And part of its nature is that it breaks down from time to time in order to realign. So the vision of perfect health forever is a fantasy.
What are we supposed to be shooting for?
I think we're supposed to be shooting for a kind of resilience or bounciness or springiness that allows us to move through a world filled with potentially dangerous agents and not get seriously hurt by them a lot of the time. That if things come at us that knock us off balance, whether it's a flu or an injury, that we bounce back from that as quickly as possible. And that's mostly by taking advantage of our own internal resilience.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
I've enjoyed this. My guest has been Dr. Andrew Weil. His book, Health and Healing, has just been revised and updated. It's a survey of alternative healthcare practices, and it's published by Houghton Mifflin. I'm Faith Middleton, and this is Fresh Air.